Hare Krishna. Welcome to all ladies and gentlemen of this gathering here in the Padyatra Pandal program meeting. So, we are waiting to listen something about this ISKCON and its Padyatra program. So, today I am going to introduce you one very significant personality of our mission, who joined this mission very beginning time of Prabhupada established this in New York, and now he is in renounced order of life and his manifold activities towards ISKCON, towards our society, is helping our ISKCON society to spread Krishna consciousness by editing Prabhupada's books and preaching directly to the society and teaching to the devotees of the ISKCON movement. And he is one of the main organizers of this Padyatra program. He is Holiness Jayadvaita Swami. So please welcome him with chanting Maha Mantra. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna, thank you very much. Feedback. Yes, good ending. Our topic in strong speaking today is a topic asked about yesterday, how to close a talk. And our theme is that a talk should have a strong ending, an ending that's planned, an ending that leaves people with a little jolt of energy, a little burst of energy. So this was an ideal ending. You don't have to lock it. You don't lock it, please. We want to leave people with a burst of energy, so this was an ideal ending, and certainly most appropriate too for a Padyatra program. So it's very good. Thank you. Practically, you saved me a whole class. I don't have to speak about how to end the talk now. I saw everyone's face just picked up a little happiness with this ending, rather than just trailing off and saying, so I guess that's about all we have to say, and without further ado, it's my great pleasure. Instead, he had a strong ending planned out. Very good. Thank you. Another person. Yes, Meen Avatar.
Hare Krishna. How many of us have actually seen the Supreme Lord face to face? Today we're going to experience a little of what that's like. In addition to teaching at the ISKCON Gurukul in Detroit, Ishvaku Prabhu has been serving their Lordship Shishi Radha Kunja Bihari for nearly 5 years now. His personal service has been very valuable. His interest in editing and his understanding and deep understanding of Vedic knowledge, Vedic scriptural reference, will make his attention to detail very keen. Today, right here in this room, we're going to be experiencing Ishvaku Prabhu is actually going to be taking us onto the altar, so to speak, to perform an authentic Vedic bathing ceremony called Abhishek, which the Lord is actually bathed by his own devotees. In addition, afterwards, the all auspicious Agnihotra sacrifice will be performed, and we're asking you to watch and listen very carefully, and we're promising everyone an opportunity to participate. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Feedback? Yes?
It felt like it was really well planned, like he knew where it was going, and you know, like all the step by step, what he wanted to draw the people, like which point he wanted to bring out and such.
Yes. Yes?
But there was an opening through the
Great opening. So much better than... So, thank you all for coming. And so our speaker today, we're very fortunate. It's great. Immediately got into it. How many of you have seen the Supreme Lord face to face? No one's going to shy away from that and say, well, looks like boredom today. He got us. From the first sentence, not the second, not the third, not the fourth, from the first word, he immediately engaged us. That's a good opening. Minavatar has gained considerably in poise and dignity from his first attempt to his second. Quite an improvement. The ending was also not bad. You're all going to get a chance to participate. Very good. The only thing that I might pick at, and it's a fairly small point, but it's a small point that's going to come up a lot, that is to say a lot of people do this, admonitions. I think we can do without admonitions to the audience. So you should all watch and listen very carefully. It's condescending. It's condescending. School children need to be told, now watch very carefully. So, avoid that. Avoid that.
Actually, I didn't plan to do that.
Yeah, it's something that comes, we've seen it done so many times that we just automatically feel that it's one of our responsibilities to make sure to remind the audience to watch and listen carefully. But it has a sort of negative effect because not only do they feel condescended to, but they feel that there's some indication that perhaps not listening and not watching is something that might be called for under the circumstances. It raises that possibility, which shouldn't even be suggested. So just do without that. It's unnecessary. Very good. Very good, Minavatar. Oh, one other thing I would say, and that is that after ending with starting with a dramatic opening, there's a little bit of a gap there between the mysterious or provocative question and the fulfillment or the indication of how it's going to be fulfilled. For those of us who, when you start with a statement like that, how many of you have actually seen the Supreme Personality of Godhead face to face? It's understood that you're talking to a rather uninitiated audience, an audience of non-devotees. And then when you say that Ikshaku has been serving Sri Sri Radha Kunja Bihari, there's a good chance that most of the audience is unfamiliar with who Radha Kunja Bihari is. In other words, you have to make that connection a little closer, that Ikshaku actually sees the Supreme Lord face to face every day, and then you either let him know how in his deity form, or else he's going to say, and today he's going to tell you how he actually sees God face to face every day and what it's like, which might be a better strategy, because then you really have him on the hook. But somehow or other, there was a gap there where it seemed that the goods had been delivered. You did tell us how he sees the Supreme Lord face to face, but it wasn't clear enough so I could really follow it.
Well, one of the questions I have about the structure of an introduction of this sort is that my impression of from my notes and so forth was that you should give qualifications of a person before. In other words, well, I don't know if that's like...
It's not a rule engraved in stone.
Yeah, right.
But that's, generally speaking, part of the program.
Yeah.
Somehow or other, your job is to arouse interest, faith and interest. Now, is there any way that you can do that is fine if it's appropriate to the occasion and to the speaker. Now, if he sees God face to face every day, that's a pretty high qualification. You don't have to say that he attended PS 132 and got straight A's in Johns Hopkins or whatever it was. Seeing God is enough qualification. It depends upon your strategy. Yes?
Maharaj, how can we induce the public everybody listen today, but make them aware that they should listen?
Making it clear that the subject matter is an interesting one, and that the speaker is a speaker they'll be happy to hear. not by telling them. Today's subject matter is a very interesting subject, and our speaker is a very qualified person that I know you'll want to hear. But rather by showing them. You tell something about the subject in such a way that their interest is invoked. You tell something about the speaker that makes them think, boy, this sounds like somebody I really want to hear. He's been a sannyasi for 15 years. He's lived on tulsi leaves and charanamrita up in the Himalayas for 17 years or whatever. You show them. You say something that piques their interest. Let me qualify that by saying that in some cases, you may have audiences that really need to be told in no uncertain terms that they have to buckle down and listen. There may really be an audience which is so much in need of that advice that you should give it, just like a school teacher gives advice to a batch of school kids. So if that's the case, that's what you do. Otherwise, just give it. And even in such cases, better if you can find a way to make it seem like it's something they want to hear. Rush?
I have a particular instance of that. It's kind of an exception, I guess, but I was doing a program in Mauritius. I was lecturing to a crowd of about 200 Indians, villagers, who were very simple. Somehow or other, they just couldn't, from the very beginning, it wasn't working. I was speaking, it wasn't working. After about 5 minutes, I stopped the lecture. I said, all right, everyone stand up. Everyone take a deep breath. Everyone follow, very simple villagers. Take a deep breath, sit down, say Hare Krishna. After a big response, Hare Krishna, and listen very carefully. Right. At that point, I had their attention.
Right. Marsh is so expert. So such extreme measures may be called for. And here's a great example of how to deal with it. Wonderful. Okay, I think we'll leave more introductions to tomorrow. Who still is left? Vamandev, Chorikanda. Oh, you spoke on a topic, but not an introduction. Okay. All right, we have lots of time. We have more days, 2 weeks more. Okay. We'll move into strong speaking, how to close a talk. The information is there on the handout. I don't think I have to say much more. A strong ending will be one of your strongest devices for capturing the attention of the audience and fulfilling your purpose, which is to move them right into the speech with full attention. Two mistakes, which are the most common, don't talk about stopping. So I guess that I've said everything that I want to say, and there's no need for me to say anything further, and without further ado, don't say any of that stuff. If it's time to stop, then just stop. Don't say that you're going to. Next thing is, don't fail to stop. To say that you're going to stop and then stop is bad enough, but far worse is not to stop, but to keep going. And well, so I guess as we've seen, as I was saying before, don't do that. If you've run out, if you've reached the end, stop. The best way to make sure you do that is to have planned an ending. Maybe not word for word, but to have in your mind a very definite idea of how you're going to end up. Dhanurdhara Maharaj took this advice last semester, and he gave, in one of his Bhagavatam classes, he ended up with the whole story of how he'd been kidnapped by Ted Patrick, and he ended with, used that for his ending. And instead of having the standard sort of Bhagavatam class curve where interest starts off someplace like here and goes like this a little bit and then gradually goes like that, he went on an upswing. So everybody was fascinated at the end. So if you can calculate or plan to have a definite end, maybe you'll have a sentence in mind, maybe you'll have a story in mind, maybe you'll have a real smashing point in mind or a quotation from Prabhupada, or maybe you're just going to know that you're going to end up with the Maha Mantra. But whatever your plan is, it's good if you have a plan. It will serve you well. Then you don't have to stumble on and on. You can know, now I've reached the point at which it's time to stop. Let me put my ending right in here and stop gracefully. Yes?
We hear sometimes in classes from local persons saying at the end
louder,
of
please.
The class.
Louder, I can't hear you.
We hear many times at the end of Bhagavatam, even from local persons saying, okay, I think I'll stop here if you have any questions or comments.
Yes, that you can do that. In a Bhagavatam class particularly, our format lends itself to that. We illuminate things point after point, and then just reach a point where we say, okay, it's time to stop. More in a more formal speech, better to plan your ending. Or in a Bhagavatam class, if you can do it, would that class be stronger if the person really ended up with something he had definite in mind? We've heard it. I do it. I'm not eloquent, but I do it lots of times. I say, all right, I think we'll stop here. But would it be better if I actually had a definite point in mind to end up with? Usually it would. Another point, another question or comment? Another point about endings. End before everyone wants you to. No one, or hardly anyone, has ever complained that the class ended too soon. Many have complained that it ended too late. It's a far better strategy. The Saturday Evening Post, in its heyday in New York, had an editor whose policy was that when they ran an article in a series, when they were running a serialized article or a series of articles, he'd always stop the series just at or just before the peak of its popularity. Rather than ride the wave to the shore, he'd take it just at the peak and cut it off, leaving them wishing that there'd been more. That made for a very exciting magazine. It also makes for exciting speeches. Maharaj.
I personally have this tendency to sometimes go on too long. And I can really appreciate to stop before your audience wants you to. And I think that the only class I ever gave where devotees came up to me afterwards and said, can you keep speaking? Can you keep going on? It was the Amazon story. You know, I left it halfway on the Amazon River and then the day about five devotees come up. We need to continue. So I learned a lesson from that.
Yeah. Yes.
You don't want to leave people hanging in midair, either, do you?
Well, you don't want to have a whole batch of loose ends, points that you started making and didn't fit. It should be a tidy business. But it should be done in such a way that you're not just mining over, you're not chewing the chewed and mining over dead minefields. You should really think. You should do it short, cut it short. This is, in the modern age especially, people like things short and snappy and to the point. Everyone's thinking about getting on to the next order of business. So if you make your Bhagavatam classes or any address that you give snappy, to the point, and particularly in your ending, if you cut it early, don't wear out your welcome, as they say. People will appreciate it more. The ending, if we fail to do that, we risk going over the same material again and again, running out of material. Lots of times, one thing you can do is sometimes when you're speaking, some point will come to you, or an idea will come to you, or a story will come to you, and after you say it, a little voice inside says, stop here. It was a really good point, or a really good story, or a really good quotation, and you could just stop and really leave it ringing in their ears. Fail to heed that voice at your own peril. It's a really good voice to listen to. It gives you two things. It gives you obedience to this rule of stopping early, and it gives you a strong ending. Rather than think, well, I still have more I could say, I've done it. I've ignored this little voice and found myself ending in far less congenial territory. Yes.
As you told me once, when you stop early, there's still room for questions, and usually questions may carry you a lot further as you wish you were going.
Right, right. Questions and answers can be the most exciting part of the class. So if you leave plenty of time for them, then your speech, which tends to be less interesting and perhaps less illuminating, is short, and the questions and answers, which could be really capturing everyone's attention and clearing up points and doing so many things, will be long. So that's, and if they're not long, you can always go back and say more if you wanted to. You can always say, that question reminds me of something that I neglected to say, but I will say. Or you can even say, yesterday, in yesterday's class, or last week when I gave class, someone asked me such and such thing. And you can start all over again if you want, if you have to, or if there's a reason to. But you rarely will you do yourself an injustice by ending your class short and asking for questions. Yes?
Should one think that if there are no questions at the end of a class, that it's been a kind of a dull class? Or should, does that indicate that at all the points hit home?
I don't. In my experience, it doesn't have a definite meaning one way or another. It depends on the circumstance. It may mean that it was really a dull class. May mean there was really a dull audience. It may mean that they simply just don't have questions about the topic. May mean that the temple's well organized and peaceful, and everyone's happy and eager to go out and distribute books.
Yeah. May mean that you answered all the questions.
May mean you answered all the questions. It really depends.
It seems that there'd be more of a tendency if you're speaking in public, not to, you know, like say to non-devotees, that you would speak in a bit more of a provocative way. Of course, philosophy is much more provocative if someone's never heard it.
Right.
So, I guess there might be a tendency to structure the two different kinds of talks. One.
Yeah, of course, according to your audience, not just two different, but as many audiences as there are that many speeches. Everything, the more you can think about how this audience will get my message, the better off you are. Yes?
Isn't that kind of broad class which asks many questions, is it a good one?
Is a class with many questions a good one? Generally, I would say so. There may be exceptions, a class with a lot of foolish questions. But generally, if people have a lot of questions and you're giving good answers, that's welcome. Questions and answers are wonderful. We'll have a whole class or two on questions and answers. But it's an excellent format for answering doubts, clearing up matters, and general preaching.
You mentioned previous to Maharaj about kind of leading the group together to draw the same conclusion with you. And in doing that so many times, you present questions yourself.
Yes.
Does that actually arouse more questions?
That's fine. You sure? Yeah. It may. It may. Okay. Let's move on. A little bit about diction. We're moving on today to messed up Sanskrit pronunciations, of which we have many. We've inherited in our society a lot of pronunciations of Sanskrit that go back to 1966. In all of our books, major books at least, we have a pronunciation guide. All of our books are done in this scholarly system, which tell you infallibly how to pronounce each Sanskrit word. What's a long A, what's a short A, what's a vocalic R, and what's a hard R. All of these things are clearly indicated. So, we should learn the system if we don't already know it. Read that guide until you understand it. If you need help, ask for it from some experienced devotee. And learn how, from any printed word in Prabhupada's books, you can understand the pronunciation. Then, give your attention to a few anomalous pronunciations which have somehow maintain respectability in spite of their erroneous nature. Pardon me? A sheet will come. So yes, you don't have to write them down. I'll supply all these. first one on the rogues list. Ananda. Sachit Ananda. It's not Ananda, it's Ananda. Long first day. Sachit Ananda Vigraha, not Sachit Ananda. Right? Indian voice? Sachit Ananda. That long mark is there over the A for a reason. Next one. Pronunciation?
Brahman.
Those who say Brahman, how do you arrive at that? No way. That's Brahman. That's Brahman. The history of this Brahman pronunciation is that way back in the old days, like 1960, 1967, there was a devotee who was one of our editors for publications, and it wanted to make clear the distinctions between different things. So, we have Brahman, Paramatman, Bhagavan, we have Aham Brahmasmi, we have the impersonal Brahman, Brahmajyoti, and it's all the same word. Actually, that's the word, Brahma. And if you hear Prabhupada talk about it, you'll find that's the pronunciation he uses. The impersonal Brahma. Right? I'm not this body, I'm Brahma. And to make things worse, we also have a Lord Brahma. So it gets pretty confusing. You just have this one word, even in the days before diacritic marks, and you have all these different meanings. So we started to make things clear. For Lord Brahma, he made it like this. Then for Brahman Paramatma, Bhagavan, he made it like that. And he introduced this pronunciation, Brahman, which doesn't exist anywhere. The word you want is Brahma, or Brahman. This N is arbitrarily there just to get rid of some of the confusion between Brahmanas and Lord Brahma and so on. But you either want Brahman or Brahma, but not Brahman. There's no such thing.
So you would say the supreme Brahman.
Yes.
It's funny because I heard that in a recent tape in LA on Bhagavad Gita chapters by, I forget his name.
Dravida?
Huh?
Dravida?
No, LA. But I was thinking you made a mistake because he said the supreme Brahman.
No, this is what you want. Supreme Brahman. Brahma Paramatman Bhagavan. Not Brahman, Brahman, Brahman. Surprises. Another one. Chaitanya Charitamrita. This Rita is a girl from Puerto Rico. Chaitanya Charitamrita. Rita that you love so well would be like that. R long I T A. And in fact what you have is this. Rita. Which is not even Rita. It's not even an I in there. It's a kind of R which is vocalized. But if you say Rita, that's all right, Chaitanya Charitamrita. Those who are pundits will say Chaitanya Charitamrita. But you don't have to be a pundit. Yeah, that's a Hindi pronunciation. Or yeah, because it's a Bengali book, Chaitanya Charitamrita. Right. But no Ritas. And the same thing goes for Prabhupada Lilamrita.
Why does Srila Prabhupada say Chaitanya Charitamrita?
He's just saying it fast. Chaitanya Charitamrita. It's a quick pronunciation.
I've never met the story. It's the end of many names. Sometimes they seem to be accented.
Stumped. They're accented.
Yeah.
They're accented. Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm cutting you off.
Well, for example, my name sometimes is Partha, sometimes it's Parthas. I don't know what.
Okay, we'll get into a short exposition of that. If a word ends like this, with a long mark over it, the A is long and its pronunciation is obligatory. O son of Prita, Jamuna, any long A at the end never gets dropped. To give another example, famous one that comes up, was going to come up later, comes up now. Puja, not Vyas Pooj. We hear there's some nasty meaning to it. Puja, you can't drop a long A. They're not droppable. Okay? Puja. Now, in Sanskrit, A is inherent in every consonant. So a J, ja, is actually ja. A ma is not just an M. If you see an M in Sanskrit, it's not M, it's ma. The A is inherent in every vowel, in every consonant. It's automatically there. Unless there's a little mark in there that cuts it off, which sometimes happens. But it's there. Okay? Now, Hindi is not like that. In the Hindi language, it's there, but it's usually dropped, or quite often dropped. So if you get Arjuna, which is the proper pronunciation in Sanskrit, the standard Hindi pronunciation would be Arjun. If you get, therefore you find, why do you find people talking about Dharam? Sanatan Dharam. We think it's a mistake, our learned Sanskrit devotees. It's perfectly good Hindi pronunciation. They're just taking that M and pronouncing it without the final A, Dharam. Hindi leaves out these short A's frequently. Sometimes it sticks them in, more or less arbitrarily. Most times it leaves them out. Therefore, you find your friends leaving out that final A on your name. But the Sanskrit pronunciation is standard. The A is there. If you see it in the book, it's there. And if it's a long A, it must be there in any case. But your Indian friends are not making a mistake in their language if they call you Parthasarathi. Standard pronunciation in Hindi. And Bengalis, not much different. They also leave out A's all over the place, except that sometimes they change them to an O sound. Did that clear things up on that? Yes?
Just, so therefore, Rama, we can also say Rama.
Yes. In Sanskrit, the pronunciation must be Rama. In Hindi, you can say Ram. And even the Sanskrit people will clip that last A pretty short sometimes. Right? It's two syllables. Properly it's Rama. But you'll hear it clipped. Yes.
What about in Kirtan? We often, of course, most of the time we hear Hari Rama, Hari Rama, Rama Rama. We don't hear Hari Rama, Hari Rama, Rama Rama.
Well, I don't have an opinion about that. Or I don't risk expressing my opinion about it. I don't like that tune anyway.
What about the word prasadam? Prasadam, prasadam.
Well, that gets into another side. That's coming from South India. In some of the South Indian languages, now they're all different down there. You've got Telugu and you've got Tamil and you've got Malayalam and so on. And in some of these languages, the standard ending for a noun is M. So you'll have a standard word, like Mandir, which is Hindi. will come out in one of those Sanskrit language, southern languages, mandiram. It's very standard, kind of, it's just the way the language is put together. And somehow or other, this prasadam is like that. It's, as far as I can understand, like a southern usage. And sometimes it's used in learned circles to call attention to the fact that you intend this word to be a Sanskrit word and not a Hindi word. They'll put the M at the end to indicate that it's supposed to be Sanskrit and not just your common, ordinary, garden variety Hindi. Am I right?
Even Krishna Mande
Jagadgurum. Yeah.
Abhishekam.
Abhishekam. Charanamritam. In South, it's always Charanamritam. In some states, always Charanamritam. It's always Mandiram. It's always Prasadam. It's always many other such ums. In the North, it's more like Charanamrit, Mandir, like that. They'll drop even the A, what to speak of adding an M. Prasad. So that's how it can go. Anyway, Srila Prabhupada used to say prasadam. So we have picked it up as prasadam. And it's perfectly understandable. Everyone will know what you mean. It's quite all right. But I think our Sanskrit editors, for the sake of consistency, have made it prasad. That's all right also. Either way. Just take to your full satisfaction. Any other questions in this line? Yes.
M with a dot on top.
M with a dot on top. Okay, when you get to, this gets to really how to pronounce verses and so on, and this will be dealt with in, those who are missing such an Narayan's class, I'm going to put in a plug for it. It's intended to give devotees a background, or sufficient background in the Sanskrit language, so that you'll be familiar with the basic principles of how the language works, what the alphabet is, how the letters of the alphabet are pronounced, the difference between the T with a little dot under it and the T that doesn't have a dot under it. These are separate letters of the alphabet, just as V and W are separate letters in English. So in his course, you'll learn all of these basic things, as well as how to chant the different tunes for mantras, how to recognize the letters of the alphabet in the Devanagari script. So it's a well-designed course, particularly intended for preachers. The first semester was too deep. It was more for people who wanted to learn Sanskrit. The course has been redesigned, and it's really aimed at those who'd like to have a good working knowledge of Sanskrit that they can use in their preaching. So these questions will be dealt with there. But in brief, these M's and N's with dots over them are nasals. So Sankirtan, it's not a hard M, but it's a nasal. In French?
Sankirtan.
No. Like, c'est bon. So that bon is not a hard M, c'est bon. It's not like that. It's a nasal sound. Yeah, so all these dotted ones, they're nasals. Okay? And there are differences between them which are too subtle to go into here. A dotted M and a dotted N, we're not going to talk about it. Well, I'll just say that M is more like is a more of an ung.
It's like an NG.
It's like an NG. Ung. It's not an M. That's a fine point. People will still understand if you say Nisringadev, but it's weird. It's Nisringadev. So that's an NG, but if you really want to get it right, it's a nasal.
But Gayatri Mantra also.
Yes, has several of those nasals. Yes?
Then what the difference between K-R-I-S-H-N-Krishna
and K-R-S-N-Krishna? One is spelled scientifically according to the Sanskrit pundits, and the other is spelled in a popular way. But it's the same word.
Pronunciation is the same?
Same. You know how to pronounce it. You're Indian.
No, but that is K-R-S-N-N.
It's the same word. It's the same. If you were to write it in Devanagari, it's the same word. But it's been spelled with an I and an H to make it simple for people in general. And it's spelled with the dots under it to make it precise for our scholarly standard. Yes?
I don't think there's anyone from Orissa here, but in Orissa they pronounce Krishna.
Krishna.
Why has that come about in Krishna?
Because there's a letter which is a vocalic R. It's all.
They pronounce the R like Ru.
They pronounce it like Ru. So whenever this letter comes up, they pronounce it Ru. So it's wild. On Padayatra, we'd have all these kirtan parties, 40, 50 men joining us, with lots of kirtan parties in Orissa. They'd come chanting us, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna. You'll hear Bhakti Purushottam Maharaj, even Gaura Govinda Maharaj, although not as much because he has a lot of Sanskrit background. But all the Aurya devotees, you'll hear this Krishna. More or less, you'll hear it. So that's very easy.
There is Leisure Short Ramaji will be talking with arguably the life member of the different pronunciations of Krishna that are there. Prabhupada concludes by saying that when someone's called, him, Krishna understands.
The one who's being called, he understands.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. I think we can take. I'm going to stretch this out, these Sanskrit mispronunciations, over several days. So I think we can take more tomorrow. Yeah, just point.
Yeah, one more.
Okay.
Bengali is practically speaking, you don't pronounce A, but always the O.
Yeah.
It's
yeah, a lot.
Ramo, Krishna.
Yeah, Ramo.
Krishna.
So we'll all be going to Bengal, we'll enjoy this sweet Bengali pronunciation. Okay. Wait. Tomorrow. Make a vow and keep it. I want to hear some more arguments or some more speeches. Let's see. You want to hear a speech or you want to get into a fight? Okay. I have not very much time left for fighting, fortunately. Let's hear a couple. Who is preparing topics? We had a list of topics.
Actually, I don't have a topic yet.
We only assigned to about three or four people different topics. Who are those people? Have they dropped out? So you're ready?
I was ready the other day.
Are you ready, Prabhuji? Tell me your name again. I keep forgetting. Hare Krishna.
Shonaka.
Shonaka. Would you like to speak? Are you prepared? Good.
Hare Krishna, Prabhupada. Today's talk is Kaitavya Karma. Every one of us has to experience karma in our lives. Lord Krishna, in the Bhagavad Gita, defines karma as actions pertaining to the development of material bodies. Basically, karma is the law of action and reaction. Everything we do in our life has a reaction. And the reactions can be either good or bad. Good reactions bring about good results, bad actions bring about bad results. And in this way, people are encouraged, living entities are encouraged to perform good actions. Because by performing good actions, they can come up to the mode of goodness. And from the mode of goodness, they can understand that the material world is not really a place for us to be in. Karma, of course, is temporary, it's not eternal. The living entity is eternal. And our job in the material world is to get free of karma. And Krishna describes in the Bhagavad Gita how we can do this. In the 9th chapter, it says, whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you perform and give away, whatever austerities you perform, do that as an offering unto me. In this way, you will be freed from the bondage of work. You will be liberated and in the end, will come back to me.
Thank you. Feedback? Bhagavan Prabhu?
Perfect.
Yes, Ikshaku Prabhu?
I really liked his presentation, except when he explained that When you brought to the mode of goodness, you understand that there's no good in the material world. It kind of left me wondering, if I didn't know anything about the philosophy, I was wondering how one would conclude that there's nothing good if you brought to the mode of goodness.
Okay. Yes? One point is that that's the kind of thing that might come up in questions. We may not be able to cover everything within our talk, and we don't have to feel obliged to explain everything that we say. Some things inevitably will be unexplained, and they can be subject matter for questions. But at least we should be sort of thinking along with our audience. If I say this, will they understand what I mean? If I use this word, is this a word that's familiar to them? So we're sort of going along in that way, in the process of communication, mentally checking out in our own minds whether we think that we're making ourselves clear.
You could do something like that on purpose, though, in other words, to kind of instir within the...
You might even do that as a strategy, yeah. Say something wild and leave it open. Could. Marsh?
I thought it was a very good presentation, philosophically very sound. The only suggestion I might make is that the devotee should remember that they're speaking to a large audience, not just people up in front. It's kind of a shy nature. Maybe a little bit louder would have been better, because I had a little bit tough hard time hearing. And notice sometimes the devotees speak just to a few people in front, but a little difficult for us to hear, actually.
I got the impression that Shonaka Prabhu was a little shy and a little in anxiety about how his presentation may be received. But he's a very good speaker. You're a very good speaker. Your ideas are organized nicely. You speak nicely. You use your hands nicely. And I think that by practice, you'll become very much at ease. And go on speaking, go on speaking. Yes?
I think it illustrates Shuruka's speech now, something that you mentioned 2 or 3 classes ago. That is that when you're working from something you've written and purely memorized, you're always in danger. There's always an element of the mind, you know, the memory not working properly. You're going to stir behind your eye. I felt with Shonka that, you know, at any moment he could forget and he'd be stuck. It was just a feeling I had.
Why don't you give us some background? Could you speak up, please?
I prepared this a few days ago, and I haven't really done my memory things. I just read it.
Did you write it out word for word?
No, not completely. I just prepared a rough
outline. Rough outline.
But the quick notations from the meeting.
Uh-huh. So, okay, good. Then that's done as it should have been done. I would add something I forgot to add the first time, and that's that your ending was very effective. One effective way to end any talk is with a strong quotation from Shastra that brings your points all together to a conclusion. You did that very well. Some other points? Yes?
Yeah, I don't know if that's good or a bad point. I had the impression that it was like the logic was presented almost in a mechanical way. Is there something we should go forward into, or something we should...
Just by experience and practice. In the beginning, our speaking will be mechanical. It will be by rules. It will be by outline or by notes. And the more we speak, the more comfortable we'll become, the more spontaneous we'll become, the more enlivened, the more powerful and connected. You'll be able to speak like Indra Dumna Maharaj, maybe, with Krishna's grace, after some time. Any other points? Okay, we have 7 minutes. Who else? Who else prepared a topic? Jayakanda? Who are you? Marsh? Oh, ready to go? All right, you're on. I'm leaving the topic of ad hominem arguments till tomorrow, when we'll have more time for them. I don't know if you're the kind of people who'll understand them.
Nice to hear that.
If the class doesn't go over well, it's not my fault. It's because you're a lousy audience.
Hare Krishna. Our topic this evening is Prakriti. In the Bhagavad Gita, in the introduction, Srila Prabhupada discusses about the word Prakriti. Actually, the whole Bhagavad Gita discusses five principles, of which Prakriti is one of them. The first principle is Ishvara. Another principle is time or kala. Another principle is karma. And another principle is Jiva, the living entity. Of these five principles, four are eternal and one is temporary. So Prakriti is one of the eternal principles of the Lord, or one of the energies, rather, of the Lord. Now, there are two types of Prakriti, which is referred to in the Bhagavad Gita. One of them is called the Paraprakriti, and one is called the Aparaprakriti. The Paraprakriti is the superior nature, that is, the living entity. It's the same as the Jiva. And the Aparaprakriti is the material nature. Actually, the Sanskrit word Prakriti means material nature. So the living entity, when he comes in the material world, under the influence of the modes of material nature, becomes entangled. And unless he comes to know about the nature and the workings of the inferior energy of the Lord, that is, the Prakriti, then he will not become so easily liberated from the entanglement in the material world. The purpose or the business of the living entity is to understand his nature as an eternal servant of the Lord and to overcome the modes of material nature and in this way return to the spiritual realm where he can enjoy eternally with the Supreme Lord.
Hare Krishna. Feedback? Yes?
We felt that he knew what he was talking about.
Yes. That was the comment I was going to make. There's no substitute for knowing Prabhupada's books. When one of our experienced philosophers speaks, it will have depth. It will have depth. So we feel that he knows what he's talking about. And that commands our attention. Yes? You got a comment?
Well, I was going to see he was quoting to the fact that...
Yes, he can back up what he says from authority. Yes?
He's very systematic, too, in his presentation.
When you know what you're talking about, you can do that. When you're bluffing, it's hard.
Yeah, another byproduct of having the all the knowledge in your head is that there's voice and no one serves you, no anxiety. You can see it in his very calm voice.
You're calm, you're poised, you feel prepared. That was a point in our earlier lectures, our earlier classes, that preparation sets you up. You feel confident, you feel at ease, your things are structured and you're not lost because you know what you're talking about. So we should be reading Prabhupada's books, assimilating the philosophy, preaching regularly, practicing. Then when we get up to speak on any topic, we'll be able to speak with confidence, with a strong voice born of knowledge. Notice also how neatly he handled the point that he forgot when he remembered 4 out of 5 items discussed in Bhagavad Gita. He didn't say, I used to know, this, that. He simply paused and thought about it, and when he was offered from the audience, he didn't make a big thing out of it, just thanked the person and went on speaking with a minimum of distraction. This is an experienced preacher. Especially if you expect that your audience knows the answer, and if you've suddenly forgotten it, which happens, then there's no harm in saying, and what's the other one, fifth one? And some person will say, quite all right. Any other points? Yes?
I like the speech. One thing disturbing me now was really unnecessary.
You reminded me of something, both by that comment and by having all that equipment in front of you. And that is that we invite you to review any talk that you give with Vasudev Prabhu. He's got it all preserved on celluloid. And if you do review it, I think you'll find it revealing. Listen to your own talk, see yourself in action, and don't be mortified. But you'll notice many of the points that we've talked about, both good and bad, during the courses. And take advantage of it. See yourself as others see you by the wizardry of Vasudev's technological setup here. So he's available, just find him out. He's staying on the opposite side of the Gurukul on this same floor. And he'll be happy to put you on the monitor.
One request, if you could come as soon soon after you spoke, reviewing the spot where it was recorded, it would make it a lot easier. Otherwise, it's quite difficult.
You're easier to find. And it's good for you too, because you'll have the impression in your mind of what you liked and what you didn't like, what you thought was good, what you didn't think was so good. So I recommend it highly. See yourself on the video and take it as an opportunity to become stronger in speaking. Hare Krishna. All the best.